From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, military clashes with separatists in eastern Ukraine, Ukraine crisis impacting Turkey's economy, frustration and anger in northern Nigeria over kidnapped girls, plus a spike in MERS raising concern. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russia is calling on the United States to force Ukraine to halt its ongoing military crackdown on armed pro-Russian separatists who are occupying buildings in eastern Ukraine. Separately, at the United Nations, diplomats say Russia has recalled its ambassador to Moscow for emergency consultations. Word of that recall came shortly after Moscow accused the Kiev government of deploying military units and ultra-nationalist paramilitary units against the largely Russian-speaking population in eastern Ukraine. Meantime, tensions have increased in eastern Ukraine as Ukrainian forces are attacking pro-Russian insurgents in the city of Slovyansk. VOA's Bryden Patton reports that separatist groups in some towns are now bracing for an attack, while others have dismantled barricades to avoid any military confrontation.
Ukrainian forces clashed with militants in the separatist-held city of Slovyansk on Thursday, days after acting president Oleksandr Turchynov ordered the resumption of military operations in eastern Ukraine. Interior Ministry advisor Stanislav Rachinsky confirms that five Ukrainian insurgents were killed in the attack.
The last information concerning the shooting in Slovyansk is that anti-terrorist forces have destroyed three checkpoints of separatists. Five terrorists were killed. From our side, there is one casualty. We still don't know exactly whether he is killed or injured. The operation continues.
Ukraine also increased its military presence outside the city of Donetsk, setting up a roadblock outside the city. A few kilometers away, pro-Russian protesters man their own roadblock. In the city of Makivka, a pro-Russian group dismantled the barricades it had built in front of City Hall. The group maintains a presence in the building but has allowed local officials back in. One member, Sergei Novakovsky, says the occupation of the building was meant as a peaceful protest.
We took it down ourselves because, anyway, barricades will never save us. And moreover, we are unarmed. We are peaceful citizens, and we are protesting peacefully the violent activity of the Ukrainian government.
In the city of Gorlivka, armed militia behind makeshift barricades maintain control of the police station. The group's spokesman declined VOA's request for an interview, saying they see no benefit in talking to the media at this time. In the city of Mariupol, Ukrainian forces reported no casualties after clearing the city hall of pro-Russian protesters who had occupied it for more than a week. Russia also announced it is starting military drills near the Ukrainian border, raising concerns of direct military confrontation between the two countries. Brian Patton, VOA News, Donetsk.
And Ukraine's Foreign Minister Andriy Dzhetsia on Thursday blasted the Russian decision to start military maneuvers.
Yeah, we are very much concerned with the Russian decision to start this military exercise even closer to the Ukrainian border than it was planned earlier. And it very much escalates situation in this region.
He also said his country will fight any invading troops.
We will now fight with Russian troops if needed, if they will invade Ukraine, to protect our territory.
Speaking to the Associated Press in Prague, Dzhetsia said his country has been taught a lesson by Russia's annexation of Crimea. He said the new Russian military exercises are taking place even closer to the Ukrainian border than it was planned earlier and demanded the withdrawal of Russian troops. Foreign Minister also called on the European Union to deploy new sanctions against Russia for their actions, saying Russia only understands the language of power. With the crisis continuing to deepen in Ukraine, concern is growing in neighboring Turkey about the economic fallout. But as Dorian Jones reports now from Istanbul, Ankara also sees opportunities.
Rising tensions between Ukraine and Russia are putting regional neighbor Turkey in an increasingly difficult position, having close political and economic ties with its Western allies and Moscow. A visiting scholar of the Brussels-based Carnegie Europe Institute, Sinan Ülgen, says there are significant risks to Turkey.
The political economic risks are increasing because the more the West hardens its position against Russia, the more it talks about introducing sanctions, the more difficult it will be for Turkey to keep a balanced act between Russia and the West.
Even though Ankara criticized Moscow's annexation of Crimea, it has not followed its Western allies and imposed economic sanctions on Russia, which is Turkey's sixth largest export market. In a move seen as a goodwill gesture by Ankara to Moscow, the Turkish national air carrier, Turkish Airlines, announced a resumption of flights to Crimea. While observers say Ankara has tried to stay on the sidelines, Finansbank chief economist İnan Demir warns Turkey will not be able to escape the financial fallout from the crisis.
If we see the tensions escalating further, then perhaps investors will be taking another look, and that won't be in emerging markets' favor either. So even though there is some scope for capital outflows from Russia finding their way to Turkey, I think the broader emerging market sentiment will be weaker, and that would have an indirect effect on Turkey as well.
With Russia providing half of Turkey's natural gas needs, much of which comes from a pipeline running through Ukraine, analysts warn the Turkish economy is vulnerable to disruption. Energy also represents a potential for powerful leverage by Moscow against Ankara, like the rest of Europe, according to political consultant Attila Yeşilada of the Istanbul-based Global Source Partners. But Yeşilada says the Ukraine crisis could eventually be to Ankara's advantage.
One way to effectively discipline Russia is to create an alternative to Gazprom's monopoly on most of European natural gas services. And that could be to accelerate the building of the Iraqi-Kurdish pipeline to Turkey and then eventually persuade Ankara to help peace in Cyprus and to reconcile with Israel so undersea pipelines can be built to Turkey.
Cyprus and Israel have recently discovered large natural gas reserves, and analysts say that could help Europe diversify its gas supply and lessen dependence on Russia. But aware of Europe's talk of diversification, Gazprom is seeking to shore up its relations with Turkey, its second largest customer after Germany. This week, Gazprom deputy head Alexander Medvedev held talks with the Turkish energy minister Taner Yildiz to expand cooperation between the countries. While the deepening crisis in Ukraine poses economic risks to Turkey in the short term, analysts predict ultimately the crisis could be a catalyst leading to Ankara achieving a key strategic goal of establishing itself as a regional energy hub. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
You can keep up to date on what's happening in Ukraine and the international reaction by going to our website, voanews.com. Still ahead, President Obama in Japan.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist. And she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
President Obama reaffirmed Thursday a decades-old treaty commitment with Japan, which extends to a chain of uninhabited islands in the East China Sea claimed by both Japan and China.
And let me reiterate that our treaty commitment to Japan's security is absolute. And Article 5 covers all territories under Japan's administration, including the Senkaku Islands.
Speaking at a joint news conference with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Tokyo, Mr. Obama said the United States does not believe the status quo should be changed unilaterally and called for such disputes to be resolved peacefully through dialogue.
My hope is that China will continue to engage with us and other countries in the region, where we do not take a position on the particular sovereignty of this piece of land or this rock, but we do take a position in making sure that all countries are following basic international procedures in resolving these disputes. And if that happens, then I think not only will China be successful, but I think there's a great potential for Chinese and Japanese cooperation, Chinese and Vietnamese cooperation, cooperation with the Philippines and China, all of which will benefit the peoples of the region.
China's foreign ministry says the 1960 U.S.-Japan Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security was reached during the Cold War and should not undermine China's territorial sovereignty and legitimate rights to the islands it calls Diaoyu. A foreign ministry spokesman said Beijing firmly opposes putting the Diaoyu Islands within the scope of the treaty and urged Washington to respect the facts, take a responsible attitude, and honor its commitment of not taking sides in territorial sovereignty issues. He calls Japan's occupation of the islands illegal and invalid. The islands occupied by Japan since 1895 were administered by the United States after World War II until they were returned to Japan by treaty in 1972. Joseph Chang of Hong Kong University tells VOA's Victor Beatty China would prefer a U.S. position that is strictly neutral in the islands' dispute.
China is certainly unhappy with the fact that the United States government has come out in a clear-cut manner to say that the security treaty covers the defense of the Senkaku Islands, the Diaoyutai Islands in dispute. However, I do believe that the Chinese leaders are aware of President Barack Obama's various gestures to avoid being seen to be in close collusion with Japan to deter China. And China appreciates these gestures, especially after the rather successful informal summit between the two presidents in California in the middle of last year. China's major concern, of course, is what will be the American position with regard to the Japanese government's efforts to revise the Constitution and to explicitly state that Japan is going to enjoy collective security rights in defense matters. So China will probably maintain a wait-and-see attitude.
Do you expect this to develop some sort of a rift in U.S.-China relations?
I don't think so. There are strong suspicions in China that the United States may be rather eager to contain China in view of China's rise. But at the same time, there is a strong consensus in China that China needs good relations with the United States, that China should not provoke the United States. And certainly, there is still a belief that the two countries must work out some kind of accommodation so that both parties can coexist and cooperate in global matters and especially on various issues in the Asia-Pacific region.
President Abe also said during a joint news conference with President Obama that the United States and Japan will be cooperating on a broad range of security and defense issues, saying that Mr. Obama welcomed Tokyo's efforts to review its exercise of collective self-defense. Will that raise concerns in Beijing?
Yes. China is quite worried about the foreign policy and defense policy orientations of the Abe administration. And the Chinese leadership, as well as the Chinese intelligentsia, are broadly concerned with the so-called whiteward swing on the part of Japanese politics, especially symbolized by various attempts to revise the Constitution and in the more immediate future to reinterpret the Constitution in a way as to confirm that it has the right of collective self-defense.
And Bonnie Glazer, China expert at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies, tells my colleague Victor Beatty, President Obama did not break any new ground, although his statement in a Japanese newspaper interview on Wednesday and his remarks Thursday do represent the first U.S. presidential statement on the issue.
This actually comes at a time when I think that the Chinese perceive that they have been dialing back on the pressure on those islands. Last year and at the end of September, after September 2012, when the Japanese purchased these islands, the Chinese were actually conducting patrols in the territorial waters around the islands almost every week. That has really been cut back about 50% since October of last year. And so I think that the Chinese probably are especially irritated that President Obama has said it at this time when I think they are trying to actually lower tensions.
So are you saying perhaps their response might be increased patrolling?
Yes, it is quite possible. I think in the next couple of days that we will see increased patrols by China. But how long they will continue a higher level of patrols remains to be seen. The Chinese have quite deliberately tried to demonize Prime Minister Abe, but are looking for other ways to mend fences to some extent with Japan by people-to-people exchanges and trying to promote other forms of cooperation. But they will not have a summit meeting with Prime Minister Abe. And there seems to be an international campaign that the Chinese are continuing to pursue to really isolate Prime Minister Abe.
Well, how will this impact U.S.-Sino relations?
Well, I think that the Chinese are quite concerned overall about President Obama's visit to the region. Of course, he's not visiting China because he will be going to China later this year when he attends the APEC meeting. And I think this visit appears to the Chinese to be a strategic encirclement tour. So this really could have some negative impact on the U.S.-China relationship. Again, I don't think the Chinese are surprised by the position itself, but I think they're quite unnerved that it was said by President Obama as he begins this tour, first to Japan and then Korea and Malaysia and the Philippines. And many of those countries, of course, are quite concerned about Chinese behavior in the region.
Bonnie Glazer, a China expert at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. She was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. As concern grows that North Korea may be preparing for another underground nuclear weapons test, a leading nuclear scientist says Pyongyang already may have acquired a device small enough to fit atop a missile. David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, explained that the North does not need another nuclear test to acquire a militarized warhead.
I think it's a mistake to think that they required this testing in order to design a militarized warhead. I think they may have gotten one from Pakistan. Or China.
But Albright also worked as an inspector for the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear watchdog, and said that doesn't rule out another North Korea test.
But what they can't get without testing is reliability. So the testing is invaluable to make sure everything works.
The assessment came amid wide speculation about the North's nuclear capability, triggered by the North's warning that it conduct a new form of nuclear test. Nick Hansen, an analyst at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University's and 38 North, says the point of future tests would be focused on increasing Pyongyang's ability to weaponize its warheads.
The only reason they're doing this in developing a warhead or a nuclear bomb is to put it on a missile.
And he added that he thinks North Korea may be preparing for multiple simultaneous tests.
So one of the things you could think of is a new form of testing would be to test two bombs simultaneously or as close as they can get it. Pakistan did that, by the way. And if you do that, you don't catch as much flack from the international community as you would if you test one off and then, 2 months later, touch another one off.
Despite growing concerns in Seoul, a U.S. research group this week said there is little evidence North Korea will conduct a nuclear test during President Obama's upcoming visit to Seoul. South Korea said this week it detected increased activity at one of the North's nuclear test sites, suggesting an underground test could be imminent.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Syrian government airstrikes killed at least 27 people, injured many others, happened at a market near the northern city of Aleppo. Activist groups, including the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, says government jets hit the crowded market in the town of Atareb, located in Aleppo province, early on Thursday. Strikes are the latest in the Syrian government's bombing campaign against rebel-held areas in Aleppo that began in December. Meanwhile, in Damascus, the United Nations was allowed to resume food distribution inside the besieged Yarmouk camp after being blocked for 15 days. A spike in the cases of the deadly Middle East respiratory syndrome in Saudi Arabia has alarmed international health officials, but regionally, authorities are offering more preventive measures for the MERS virus. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo.
Saudi Arabia announced two more MERS-related deaths and two new infections Thursday, one day after the World Health Organization renewed concerns about the dramatic jump in the number of victims in recent days. Health ministries from Saudi Arabia to Egypt have tried to downplay the threat of Middle East respiratory syndrome. The coronavirus, which proves fatal to about one-third of its victims, first appeared in Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. Saudi officials report nearly 300 people have come down with the disease's pneumonia-like symptoms since then. More than 50 of those cases have been reported in the past week. Regional authorities say there is no cause for alarm or need to impose preventative measures such as travel restrictions. Dr. Amr Kandil, chief of Egypt's health ministry's preventative sector, says his agency has set up screening sites across the country to check suspected cases.
The total sample examined from human cases, it is about 8,500 cases, and all of these samples were negative to the MERS corona.
But Kandil said the probability for a MERS outbreak remains, given frequent travel by Egyptians to Saudi Arabia's religious sites and workers throughout the region. He also notes the virus is present in some Egyptian camels. The disease, believed to have crossed over to humans from camels, first appeared only to be passed through close contact with the animals. But recently, health workers treating people with MERS have themselves fallen ill. Cases tied to human-to-human contact have also spread to other parts of the Gulf and as far afield as Europe and Malaysia, raising concerns the virus may be either reaching a tipping point or mutating. Part of the lack of urgency on prevention may be tied to virus fatigue, scares tied to other viruses, including avian flu, which did not live up to the warnings they could mutate into more transmissible form. Much remains unknown about Middle East respiratory syndrome. Earlier this week, Saudi Health Minister Abdullah bin Abdulaziz Al-Rabiya conceded as much, even while arguing against the need for aggressive preventative measures.
Hopefully that we will reach to an idea why the surge is in April and May. Could it be that this season is the best for the virus? We don't know. We have no idea.
The next day, the minister was replaced. No reason was given, but with Saudi Arabia expecting millions of visitors in the coming months, during Ramadan in July and the Hajj in October, it's a possible sign the threat is being taken more seriously. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
And the U.S. Federal Communications Commission set to propose new internet rules on net neutrality. Agency also will propose enhancing government oversight of charges for the net internet to ensure that no do not harm competition or limit free speech. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America. Reminder, you can always find International Edition on the internet at voanews.com. Latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On April 25th, 404 BC, Spartan armies defeated the Athenians, ending the Peloponnesian War. In 1599, Oliver Cromwell, leader of the English Revolution, was born. Cromwell, whose forces defeated those of King Charles I, took the title Lord Protector. He conquered Scotland and Ireland, expanded the English Empire, introduced electoral reform, and encouraged some religious toleration. Soon after his death, the English monarchy was restored. On this day in 1607, a Dutch fleet surprised a Spanish flotilla anchored at the Bay of Gibraltar. The Spanish warships, which were threatening Dutch trade in Asia, were destroyed. In 1859, construction began on the 163-kilometer-long Suez Canal that connects the Mediterranean and Red Seas. It took 10 years to complete. In 1898, the United States formally declared war on Spain. The U.S. victory in the Spanish-American War effectively ended the Spanish Empire. Spain ceded Puerto Rico, Cuba, Guam, and the Philippines to the United States. In 1908, American radio and television journalist Edward R. Murrow was born. Murrow is best remembered as a radio reporter giving on-the-scenes coverage during World War II. In 1915, the landings of Allied troops began at Gallipoli in Turkey. It was a bid to open a new front in the First World War and knock the Ottoman Empire out of the conflict. The effort failed and brought high casualties. On this day in 1945, Russian and American troops met along Germany's Elbe River, cutting the retreating German army in half. 2 weeks later, Germany surrendered in World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 25th, we observe World Malaria Day to highlight the global effort to effectively control this terrible, yet largely preventable and treatable illness. Malaria is caused by a parasite called Plasmodium, which is transmitted through the bite of an infected female mosquito. Once it enters the body, the parasite multiplies in the liver and then infects red blood cells, causing fever, severe headache, and other symptoms. In some cases, the disease can progress to coma and eventually death. About half of the world's population, nearly 3.4 billion people, is at risk for malaria, primarily those living in developing countries. In 2012, 207 million people became infected with the disease, and 627,000 of them died, 482,000 of whom were children. Most of these deaths could have been prevented. Still, the news is good, and the situation is improving. According to the World Health Organization's 2013 World Malaria Report, global efforts against malaria have saved some 3.3 million lives since 2000 and reduced malaria mortality rates by 49% in Africa and 45% globally. The news is even better for children. The rate of malaria mortality among kids under the age of 5 is down 51%. In 2012, for the first time, fewer than 500,000 children died of malaria. Yet more needs to be done. To help fund the fight against malaria, President Barack Obama announced last December that the United States will provide $1 for every $2 contributed by the rest of the world to the Global Fund to fight HIV, TB, and malaria, up to $5 billion by 2016. We're knocking on the door of doing what many 15 years ago deemed impossible, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry shortly after the release of the World Health Organization's report. We can beat malaria, one of the most intransigent diseases on the planet, by bringing together governments, business leaders, philanthropists, donor agencies, and citizens in malaria-endemic countries to end deaths from this preventable and treatable disease, we're making tremendous, unparalleled progress.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.